I'm Libby Price, you're with a Country Breakfast on RN. Whenever farmers moan about the parlous state of agriculture, the stock answer has become, wait until we become the food bowl of Asia. Well, this morning you'll hear two very different stories that might make you think it's just pipe dreaming. From farmers who are ripping out their fruit trees because they simply can't find any lucrative market, to scientists saying with so little spent on research, it's just not going to happen. So travel the country with our rural reporters. But before that, let's find out what's been making news this week with Edwina Farley. Good morning, Edwina.
Morning, Libby.
Now, the latest report by the Climate Commission confirms what many have been thinking.
Yes, it did. The report, which was released this week, warns extreme floods like those experienced in Queensland this year and, in fact, over the last few years, could become an annual occurrence later this century. Scientists say for the first time there's a strong consensus that climate change is now having a noticeable effect on weather events, so significant events like droughts, floods, etc. Climate Commissioner Professor Will Steffen says there's also clear evidence that the climates of southwest Western Australia and southeastern Australia have permanently changed.
In both of those areas, there have been prolonged drying trends, particularly in the cooler months of the year. So people living in rural areas there should not expect the previous wetter conditions that prevailed over much of the 20th century. I don't think it means the end of agriculture, but it certainly means that those farmers that are adept, nimble, understand the science, will be those who will be successful in the future.
Now, quad bikes, also known as ATVs, are not just deadly, they're expensive.
They certainly are. They're costing about $30 million every year, the deaths caused by quad bikes. A study by the Australian Centre for Agricultural Health and Safety looked at the economic effects of the 124 deaths over the past decade. The report's author, Associate Professor Tony Lower, says expenses included everything from crash investigation and hospital costs to insurance payments and loss of income.
We do know that children accounted for around 20% of the deaths in this 10-year period, but only around 12% of the cost. So a lot of the cost is actually borne by the most productive age groups, and that's in the years between sort of 25 and 34 years of age.
How do you value the life of a child? Now, ABC Four Corners has done it again, an expose this time on coal seam gas.
Yes, and specifically the approval process for coal seam gas projects. A whistleblower basically came to the program and told a sort of litany of instances in which mining approvals and the environmental impact assessment associated with CSG projects were fatally flawed, according to this person. She says the Queensland government didn't have enough information to properly assess two of Australia's biggest CSG developments. Now, at the moment, the Productivity Commission is studying the approvals process for major projects across the country, and there's a whole host of submissions from various minerals councils and other groups. Environmental scientist Ian Woodward agrees the process is flawed.
There are too many studies done. They're just not appropriately focused studies. They largely relate to how the project will be managed once it's operating. And they're very important issues, but they don't need to be dealt with up front. Because so much effort is put into operational studies, inappropriate amount of effort is given to the fundamental issues.
And the mining companies are saying it's not our fault, it's the government's.
Yes, Santos spoke this week and it says that, you know, the claims that this process is flawed, especially for its $18 billion coal seam gas project in Queensland, aren't true. Of course, Santos was highlighted as one of those being particularly concerning in that Four Corners program. And the scientist that blew the whistle in the first instance says she was told point blank there'd be no groundwater assessment. But Santos Managing Director David Knox says there were extensive groundwater studies.
We did extensive groundwater studies throughout the process, and our final submission with our supplemental EIS contained a very large report, 206 pages of independent studies. And that's what I'm really concerned about, is there's some falsehoods and dishonest claims being made.
Still talking water, and the ACCC seems to have its finger in just about everything in irrigation.
Yes, we talk about the ACCC a lot these days, but some relatively bright news. Fewer irrigators are leaving the industry in the Murray-Darling Basin because water water is much cheaper and there's more of it in storage thanks to a bit of rain in the last couple of years. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission released its annual water monitoring report for the 2011-12 season. There's been a significant fall in the number of farmers terminating their water rights. Commissioner Joe DiMarzi says reforms to irrigation rules have given farmers more certainty.
And I think that people realise that you don't have to sell out your rights. You can trade for a year or as you need and stick around for the future. Of course, it's got to rain. In the drought, things were very, very tough.
And to animal welfare now, the animal liberation movement is using some not-so-secret weapons.
Well, no, it's promising to operate within the law when it uses an unmanned drone to collect evidence of welfare breaches, particularly in feedlots without adequate shelter. It's a $14,000 hectocopter drone, which was purchased by the animal rights group in New South Wales, Queensland and the ACT with help from private donors. Executive Director of Animal Liberation, Mark Pearson, says an application has now been made to the Civil Aviation Safety Authority to actually use the drone. He's defended use of the controversial technology in what is a very, well, highly sensitive area of animal welfare.
No feedlot in Australia has been prosecuted for exposing their animals to excessive heat. And there are many situations where animals have been left to die from starvation and thirst and have not been euthanized. So this is a very necessary instrument.
But the Civil Aviation Authority is saying you do have to jump through a few hoops yet.
You certainly do. There's a whole lot of criteria that any organisation has to satisfy before it's allowed to operate a drone. Peter Gibson from CASA says that if anyone has concerns that any drone isn't being used safely, they can seek further investigation.
Of course, with remotely piloted aircraft, you do get some privacy concerns. They're outside safety, so they're not something that the Civil Aviation Safety Authority can look at. But of course, the normal laws of the land, privacy laws and other laws, both state and federal, do apply.
Let's stick with animal welfare for a moment. Rodeos are forming a united front.
Yes, they are. The Australian Rodeo Federation will represent at least 450 rodeos and 4,200 members nationally, and it's promising to address animal welfare issues. Traditionally, state bodies establish their own welfare rules, but the National Animal Welfare Strategy is funding the sport to develop its own set of national guidelines. Glenn Mansfield from the association says ongoing criticism from some animal rights groups has damaged the sport's reputation.
The perception of rodeo has gone through hell, really, the last few years with animal rights groups, misleading information and other issues they go on about. And it's the same with any industry that uses animals. We really do need to stand up to them kind of attacks.
One area where the perception's gone up is the ethical food movement.
Yeah, it's interesting, although the question sort of remains, you know, will you pay for it? Researchers in the United States are saying that consumers are generally becoming more willing to shell out a bit more for food that's produced ethically. Of course, last week, Aldi pledged to move to sustainably sourced seafood, and Coles has made moves along the caged egg lines and also pork produced from sow stalls that's been removed from its private label range. Harvard University professor Michael Hiscox says fair trade and other ethical labels have increased sales by as much as 10% for some products.
A lot of people thought organic was a niche market, but it's continued to grow. The fair trade market, for example, has grown faster than the organic market ever grew, so it's growing at about globally at over 30% for over 10 years now. I think the trends are all very clear, is that all of these things have become going to become more salient and important over time.
Don't hear the word salient that often anymore, do you?
Mm-hmm.
Now, we are edging closer to the federal budget, and of all things, the first out of the start box to have a moan about it are cider producers.
That's right. They've said this week that the industry will be decimated if any changes are made to the way cider is taxed. Sam Reed from Cider Australia says the growing industry has been a big boost for apple and pear growers, and it's created a lot of jobs. He says the spirit industry is trying to change the tax system for cider, which would quadruple the tax on a glass of cider.
There's been a lot of growth in the cider market recently, and that growth would be stopped overnight, I'd suggest, and there'd be probably a 30% plus decline in the marketplace. That would have a devastating effect on producers of cider and their families around Australia.
We keep hearing how depressed the Australian wool market is. Well, alpaca wool growers are a lot more confident than their merino cousins.
They are. It does make a very soft jumper, I have to say. Then they're seeking out new markets, mainly in China at the moment. A group of 500 producers have banded together and labelled themselves premium alpaca. They're trying to fill orders for alpaca wool to be turned into high-priced clothing. Now, the group has already had some success. In February, it sold the finest alpaca bale ever produced for a world record price of $10,000. Paul Vallely coordinates the orders for China.
Instead of sending off one bale of alpaca fibre every 6 months, we're in a situation now where we're getting orders for a ton or 500 kilos or whatever it might be of not ultra fine but super fine or maybe fine medium grades of alpaca.
And this is a fruit I've never heard of.
No.
How do you say it? Jujube.
Jujubes. Jujubes. I always thought of those as lollies, personally. But no, they're originally from Central Asia and they've been brought to Australia by the CSIRO. They look a little bit like plump dates. 18 trees have been planted as a trial at Shepparton East in Victoria, and grower Vincenzo Rigoli is hopeful it's the start of a new market.
We've been sending some in Sydney, some in Melbourne, all really looking forward to get a big quantity, and price is very high. We're looking about the $15 kilo mark. The fruit is very spectacular. It's really nice, nice taste. When people try it, they go really hooked on that.
Yum, I want to try one. Edwina, thank you.
Thanks, Libby.
Edwina Farley with this week's Rural News. Rural Reporter is next.
Hi there, Geraldine Duke here. Can Australians and Asians be creative mates anytime soon? That's the question I posed to a panel of luminaries in Brisbane this week as part of the Goma Talk series, and they had some very candid answers, replete with hope and realism about our need to know our strengths in this Asian century. And big political pendulum swings in Queensland especially. Why is it so? Don't miss Saturday Extra after 7:30 here on RN.
You're listening to A Country Breakfast on RN. Let's get out and about with our rural reporters. This week, we follow the fortunes of five cows swept away in floodwaters 2 months ago. A rescue operation's underway to get them off their temporary island home. At Sydney's Royal Easter Show, they've taken yarn bombing to new heights, knitting a cosy woolen jumper for, of all things, a vintage caravan. And after a lifetime in the industry, Mel Johnson is inducted into the Shearers Hall of Fame. But as you'll hear, he nearly didn't make it.
The elder shearer said to me, "Mel, you're better off getting a job at the abattoirs, because you'll never make a shearer." And I said to myself, "Well, I'm going to prove you fellas wrong. I'm going to be very determined." I'll never let up.
He's even shorn sheep for the Queen. Mel Johnson and his life on the board's coming up. But first, let's pull on the gumboots and try and save some cows.
Are you guys just going to stand here and hold her there, are you?
Only if she starts coming back this way, Ron.
She's a little disorientated. She doesn't know which way to go. She's trying to go back the other way. She thinks her house is the other way, but actually her house is straight ahead of us. So she just wants to come back, and she's pretty upset.
The she in question is a Charolais cow, one of five that's been stuck on a small island near Bundaberg since devastating floods hit southern Queensland in late January. Floodwaters had washed them about 3 kilometres from their home paddock, and all efforts to rescue them over the past 2 months had failed. Until today, that is. Hello, I'm Eliza Rogers. The island here is surrounded by thick mangroves and even thicker mud, making it almost impossible to walk the cattle out at low tide. Then someone came up with the novel idea of building a 25-metre-long carpet bridge. The cattle would be able to walk across the worst of the mud to dry land. Well, that's the theory. So how's it been working in practice? Three cows have made it across so far. There's just two more to coax along the carpet. Caroline Ferris is the cow's rescue coordinator. She lives next door to their owner and has spent 5 weeks figuring out how to get them off safe and sound. Now, I noticed you guys are taking it pretty steady, though. You've got dogs and a four-wheeler, but you're not really overwhelming her. What's the secret to moving them?
We're playing this by ear. She's just going to work her way out. She's just going to calm down for a bit and let her head rest, more to the point than her body. Let her settle down, and hopefully she'll just walk out. Maybe when we get the fifth one out behind her and the two can go out together, she needs something to follow at this stage.
Tell me what's happened here today. How many people have you got? Who have you got here? And when did you start?
Not sure on how many people here. We've got a station owner with loads of experience. We've got a station manager with heaps of experience. We've got a couple of people here with smaller operations around Childers, and they've got a fair bit of experience with cattle. We've got the owners of the cattle here, myself, my child, and we have a vet nurse and her husband here as well on site.
All right, now, Caroline, we'll wander up to the pretty elaborate system you put in place today to move the cattle. You've had three attempts. You were thinking of borrowing a barge to move them. You had quite a few obstacles.
It's not really an option to borrow a barge at this stage. We don't think a barge can get into where the cattle are, and there's just a few other issues with rocks, and we don't want any of them getting hurt.
You had the carpet donated, and a lovely little boy actually gave a pretty special donation. Tell me about that.
We have the rug off his floor. He donated it. We weren't going to use it, but we just had to use it because he just wanted to rescue the cows. He's from Maryborough. He was brilliant.
Yeah, that's great. Now, you had to kind of reinforce the carpet a bit. What did you do there?
We've got some steel mesh underneath, but holding it up, keeping it tight.
No worries. And you've got it lined with some bright orange tape to guide the cattle through. How did it all go? Were they pretty stressed when they ran through, or were they pretty orderly?
They were pretty stressed. They weren't marching two by two like Noah's Ark. They were, they were worried. They were balked by the orange construction tape. They didn't want to go in. We let them stand there for a good half an hour and think about it and just look.
You've got the fifth one cruising around a couple of Ks that way. How long do you have? You're racing against the clock in terms of the tide.
We've probably got until 4 o'clock this afternoon before we have to call it.
And if you do have to call it, will you come back for a...
I think so. It's not over yet.
Caroline, we're just coming up to the electric yards leading us into about 25 metres of the carpet. How long did it take you to set up this morning?
We got here at 9 and we're pulling the stuff through in high tide, so that slowed us up because we had to set it up obviously before low tide. Good 3 hours.
And what are you going to do once you're finished?
We're going to pull her all down.
If that cow comes down,
we'll just run. We're walking on the carpet. We're almost at the end. It looks incredibly boggy. You can see some hoof prints that have just dipped right down. There's even a tree here that's been snapped off. Was this the worst bit?
It was the first couple of times, but now the worst bit's on the other side of the creek where you can see, obviously, when they're trying to get up onto the mainland before they can see that there's solid ground ahead of them.
We're kind of walking backwards through the carpet corridor, backwards to the way you brought the cattle. Now, if we turn around, you've run the cattle off quite a wide grassy area into a dark mangrove kind of corridor. Looks pretty ominous. Did that really spook them, the look of that?
The setup of the wing fence did, yes. They see the wing fence. They think they've got nowhere to go. It's only until they get right in close that they realise they've got a place to go.
I'm Wendy. Wendy Harlan. I own the cattle. 2 months of sleepless nights, visualising what it was like to go down through that fast water. They're all pets, all my pets. I was there when they were born. They followed me around like little white puppy dogs, and even though they're big now, they're still my babies.
What will you be doing with them now? Will they be going back to where they were on adjustment near Ferrymead?
No, they're going home. For a bit of love and cuddles.
They're looking pretty dirty at the moment. They might need a bath when they get home.
I shampoo them in the Childers red soil. I used to think, oh, you're grubby, and I'd take them down and to the yard and shampoo them.
Unfortunately, there's not too many of us left. That's the thing that's sort of worrying the old bullockies now, that this is, to my knowledge, the only team left in Tasmania. And this is a part of what I've got here. I've got 8 here. I've got another 6 at home that we're getting going to come into the team. It is disappointing to see that it's an era of life that we sort of lost.
Brian Fish is known as the last bullocky in Tasmania. He runs a team of bullocks on his farm at Oatlands in the Tasmanian Midlands and regularly takes them on the road to country shows around the state, delighting the crowds with his demonstrations. Hello, I'm Margot Foster. Brian is in his 60s now, and he's one of the younger members of the Australian Bullock Drivers Association. He feels it's vitally important to keep this piece of Australian history alive, as modern tractors and prohibitive feed costs see the number of working bullocks decline.
Every chance I get at home, I haven't got to use them. I've got tractors and that, you know, all machinery on the farm, but I do a lot of the work with them to keep them going and to bring them to these sort of shows. And I've got here at the moment, the team's not as smooth as I would like them to be. I've got a young team. I've only got three of the older bullocks left that was here last year, and I've got five young bullocks in the team. And you've sort of got to have them, you know, coming along all the time and coming from behind, because the real old favourite, old Mickey, that most showgoers throughout Tasmania know, went lame only a week or so ago because he couldn't come. So we've had to drag another younger one out to the back of the team and turn him into a leader. But, yeah, it's coming along, and, yeah, it's just something that, from the original question, I guess, is that we just love doing, just love keeping that heritage going. We've got a museum going on the farm at Oatlands that we invite people to come and see. It's a little private museum of all the old bullock equipment, the drays and the wagons and all those things that the bullocks used. And, yeah, just trying to keep it all together for future generations. And the three people that come to the bullocks, you've got the kids from the school kids that come along and they've got that wow factor and say, oh, gee, look at that, what is it? You've got the 45 to 65-year-old saying, well, I remember when grandfather used to talk about this, or father did this or something. And then you've got the old chap that I'm waiting for every time I go to the show that's 80-plus, that has worked them or been where there's been bullocks and can come along, and I just love to pick his brain and, you know, get all that old information that, unfortunately, it's going to be gone.
What is a bullock?
A bullock's a castrate, no particular breed. Quite often the bullock, the one that was turned into a bullock, was the one that was too weedy or too stunty or wasn't good enough to go to market. So the old original bullocks, you just put him in the team and start working. But there's definitely no breed. You don't say that's a nice cow to breed a working bullock from. Working bullocks was just something that you liked the look of him or you put him into the team. People had, like myself, have got particular soft spots for different breeds. Devons was used a lot here in the state. Shorthorn used a lot of the mainland, but going from that, you might have seen the team there this morning of nearly every coloured shape and size in the team that's possible to have. So.
That's right, but they're big and strong and they were dragging a log around. Tell me the kind of work you might put a bullock team to use for.
Well, at home we pick up stones with them and we drag all our firewood in and we do some harrowing, and basically what it does to, you know, take to run a farm, we do at home. I like to keep them doing different things. There's a lot of bullockies you talk to that have only ever dragged logs, and that's what I did out there this morning. So, yeah, we at home do basically everything that a normal farm would do, but a lot of the original old bullockies were just in the bush.
See, I don't think I could just go in and do that, because you were communicating to those animals in a way that's obviously been developed over time.
For sure. You've got to be, what I just said then, was forceful. You've got to be dominant, but not to the stage where they're frightened of you. If you notice, then there's not one of those bullocks that are frightened of me, because if you see a team of bullocks that are frightened, they can run off and they can do all sorts of things. You've got to be forceful enough for them to have their attention, and that's, of course, what the whip's for. I think as soon as a lot of people see you pick up a whip, they think you're going to hit them with it. But if anybody gets hitting those bullocks or any bullocks, they just run away because you've got no control to hold them.
So really, you were just tickling them with the whip?
Just to get their attention, yes.
And also cracking the whip for the sound.
The big loud crack. You know, when I crack that whip, they know something's going to happen. So they know they've got to change direction, they know they've got to stop or start. So the actual crack of the whip, I'll crack the whip and they say, come here, Major, or come here, Smoker. And that crack of the whip just gets them thinking about that there's something going to happen. So that's basically what the whip's for.
Okay. Now, you had a bit of a language going there when you were talking with them. They've all got names. They all respond to that, I'm assuming?
Most certainly they've all got names, yes. They've definitely got to have a name because they do work off their name. Particularly your two leaders you've got now. I've got Major, and he's been the good old leader now for probably 14 years. He's been in the front, and he knows exactly how I feel. So if I call on Major, he'll do something. The other little fella this morning was Smoker. It's taken him a while to come, but with Major being so experienced that he can just about control the little fellow anyway. But if the other little bloke's got any brains, within two or three shows and a few more weeks at home, that he'll be doing the same thing. I can call on him, and he'll come and turn away and come back.
So who are you teaching your skills to so that others might be able to know how to actually lead a team?
Unfortunately, nobody. I've been in bullocks now for 14 years in pretty well full time with them, and travelled Australia and New Zealand working with bullocks and driving bullocks, and even in the mainland states there's just nobody coming along. And when I first joined the Australian Bullock Drivers League, I'm coming on 66 and I think I'm one of the younger ones that's on it, so it's not looking real good for the heritage to keep going. We get a lot of people that are very interested, enough to know how to drive a team and everything. Of course, the other thing that can happen with a team of bullocks is that they take a lot of feeding. You've got 16 bullocks or you've got two bullocks or whatever, and there's a chap at Whitemore that's got one bullock going and he's having a lot of fun with that, and we're giving him a lot of help. He's got the bug, so he's going to get another one going. Hopefully he'll have two. But of course, it does come to the big problem when you've got a big team. You've got to have somewhere that you can run them, and they take a lot of running, and that does dampen a lot for, you know, for some people that haven't got the farm to do it. And I guess for some reason we've gone away from anything that's a little bit hard, and it can be hard work, it can be trying work, but it's, you know, it's all worth it in the finish when you get there, and to see a team working. And I said this team's got a little bit to be done with it yet, but once you really get there and get that team working and see the look on people's faces, it's just wonderful.
Brian Fish, keeping old bullocky traditions alive in Tasmania. Now, speaking of old timers, in a moment we catch up with shearer Mel Johnson. He's just been inducted into the Shearers Hall of Fame, and a cosy caravan brings back memories in Sydney.
You expect to find a bit of wool in the sheep pavilion at Sydney's Royal Easter Show, but an entire 1950s vintage caravan wrapped in a cable knit jumper. Well, that's another thing entirely. Hello, I'm Kim Honan, and this big woolly cardigan is the surprise hit of this year's show. The project was commissioned by the Woolmark Company, the marketing arm of the wool industry, and a local lifestyle magazine, which approached one of Australia's last woolen mills to take on the challenge. Nick Bradford from the Nunda Woolen Mill from up near Tamworth in northwest New South Wales was the bloke responsible for spinning the yarn and finding a group of knitters prepared to tackle the massive job. Bob and Yvonne Kerr from Leppington in Sydney supplied the vintage van, and voila, a snug little caravan is rolled into place.
We are one of the last woolen mills still operating in Australia. We run machines. Our carding line, for example, was built in 1914, so next year's going to be quite a celebration. It's going to be 100 years old. It still works today just as well as the day it came off the production line 100 years ago. Beautiful old machine.
And you've had a very special project that you've been working on, which is now centre display here in the Sheep Pavilion, a vintage caravan from the late 1950s wrapped in knitted wool. Amazing.
It's been a very cool project. Australian Country Style approached us to knit a jumper for a caravan, and we managed to find 8 very energetic knitters from Nundle who set about making this project.
How long did it take?
Well, we had to make the yarn first. So most jumpers for human beings are knitted with an 8-ply yarn. We produced a 48-ply yarn, so we took an 8-ply yarn and did it, roved it 6 times, and produced a yarn about the thickness of your little finger. And then the knitters set about knitting a cable jumper.
And did they need extra big knitting needles for that?
We didn't. We actually used 8mm needles because we thought that there might be a bit of stretching going on. We didn't want to be able to see through the yarn. So we used a 10mm needle, which has produced a very tight knit. But what had actually happened is the cable has almost become three-dimensional. So the cable actually sits out from the caravan.
Okay, so how much wool would have went into making that jumper? How much fleece from how many sheep?
In total, we used about 1,150 gram balls. So that's a total of about 55 kilos of yarn. And if we put that in sheep perspective, a sheep produces about 6 kilos greasy, which will produce about 3.5 to 4 kilos clean. So on that basis, we about the production of about 20 sheep.
What do you think of the end product?
We love it. We love it. And the reaction today has been overwhelming. People have come up to us and said it's the number one attraction at the Sydney Royal Easter Show. So how cool is that?
The owners of that caravan, Bob and Yvonne Kerr from Leppington, join me now. How are you going, guys?
Pretty good, thank you.
What do you make of the job that the ladies from the Nunda Woolen Mill have done to your van and the knitted jumper?
It was a lot of work for them. It did. It took months, and they just non-stop knitting. And they were happy with it. When we took it, we went up to Nunda with the caravan and had it fitted up there. And then we put it on a car trailer and brought it back home.
Bob, it's not a very big caravan. It looks like it's just enough room for yourself and Yvonne.
It is, and Bob being so tall and the caravan's not as quite as wide as him. So we put the table down and Bob sleeps at the back and I sleep on the mattress at the front.
Oh, it's no fun.
I'm old. I'm 74.
How often is it on the road travelling around the country?
We usually use it when we're travelling with other vintage caravan people. There have been a couple of trips. I mean, we've been up to Bundaberg, just the caravan, us, towed by an FJ Holden. But we go down to Coaldale nearly every year with a group of vintage caravan people, Kendall's Beach. It goes out quite often. It's not the only vintage caravan we have. It becomes a bit of an obsession. We've got three of them. When we were up at Nundle, at the Nundle Woolen Mill, and the eight ladies who knitted this jumper came to the mill to finish the thing off, one of the ladies became very nostalgic when she saw the van, and the next day she brought in a photo of a van that her and her husband spent their honeymoon in 1951. When we have the van on display, people often comment about how they had their honeymoon in a van. Exactly the same, always. But it brings back a lot of nice, nostalgic memories to a lot of people.
When I've been presented for the World Title Championship there, that one, and that's all the place getters, eight place getters. And move on, you can get that big one out of the Lands Room. It's a beauty.
And you also got this one.
At Shearing at the Windsor Castle, that one. Yeah.
There's not many people in the world who can say they've shorn Queen Elizabeth's sheep or who've done a shearing demonstration on the top floor of the old Grace Brothers department store in Sydney. But Mel Johnson can, and let me tell you, he's got the pictures to prove it. G'day, I'm Skye Manson, and I've just been sitting in Mel and Yvonne's living room here in Orange in central west New South Wales, where it is clear to see he's had a lifetime of shearing. The room's dotted with all sorts of amazing photographs and memorabilia from shearing competitions and demonstrations that he's done all over the world. And now he has to find room for just one more award. And this one is a pretty special one. This year, Mel is being inducted into the Australian Shearers Hall of Fame at Shear Outback at Hay in New South Wales. He says it's one of his greatest achievements. So how did a young bloke from Carcor end up travelling the world shearing sheep? Did he always want to work in the shearing shed?
No, actually I was going to go into the Navy at the age of 16. Where I lived there was no high school, I never went to high school, but after the school I used to duck over to Kevin Malloy's shearing shed at Gallimont near Manjurama, and I loved being in the shed, and I used to try and escape school early so I could get over there and meet the boys and that, and I definitely wanted to be a shearer.
What did you think when you first dug the shears in?
Well, I thought my arm was going to shake off with the machine, but that's the same with anybody that's never held one. And yes, and when we finished the shed, the other older shearers said to me, "Mel, you're better off getting a job at the abattoirs, because you'll never make a shearer." And I said to myself, "Well, I'm going to prove you fellas wrong. I'm going to be very determined. I'll never let up."
At what point in time in your career did you know that you were all right? That you were doing a good job and that shearing would probably be your whole career?
Well, it took me 12 months before I shore 100 in a day, and that was very slow. But after about 2 years, everything came into place. I had an idea in my head, don't rush, go slow, learn it properly, and you may get somewhere in later life. And it paid off. But it would have taken 2 years to do what I did, whereas I could have done it in 6 months and never been a good shearer. So I was really dedicated to my job.
And I bet for those whole 2 years you had those blokes digging you in the ribs saying, "What are you doing? This is not for you." Is that right?
That's correct. And I only wish they were around now and I'd say, "See." They were the ones that really helped me and didn't know it when they told me I'd never be a shearer. You know, I just had to keep going to prove them wrong.
As we sit in your living room, we are surrounded by your memorabilia and personal photos of places where you've shorn sheep all over the world for all sorts of different personalities, very famous people. What's been the highlight for your career, Mel?
I've got two or three highlights now. Shearing the Queen Sheep, I was invited to do those. Winning the world title in America, and now being inducted into the Hall of Fame at Hay, which I'm very, very proud of, being selected to do that, because you either got to be 100 years old or passed away before they select you, and I've made it in time.
Let's talk about shearing the Queen's sheep. What was that like?
Well, that was something that I didn't ever think I'd be able to do. I didn't get excited. Robin Reeks was her representative. I saw the Queen, but I didn't actually meet her. I was there for 2 days and I'd done as best as I could for it, and they were very, very proud of me.
You sound like when you were competing, you were pretty cool, calm and collected. But when it came to shearing the Queen's sheep, did you get nervous?
Well, not really nervous, but I knew I had to do the right thing, and I didn't want to cut a sheep there or do the wrong thing. And of course, Robin Rees would have reported it back. So I did my best and it paid off, and I was very pleased when it was all over.
And did you get any acknowledgement from the Queen? A bit of a wink or a bit of a nod of acknowledgement?
No, not really, no. No, she knew I was there, but they tried to arrange for me to meet her, but she had other commitments. But anyway, I suppose that's the things in life.
I'd love to get your reflections on the shearing industry now and, you know, some of the records that are broken. It's quite common to have 200 head of sheep shorn in a day by a shearer. What are your thoughts about it?
Well, I probably shouldn't comment on this because I don't want to degrade anybody, but the sheep in the older days were rough marinas where they shore a lot of sheep. The ones they break records in now are not rough marinas. Yeah. So that is a big difference in my opinion.
A shearer to the Queen and now inductee into the Shearers Hall of Fame, Mel Johnson, speaking with Sky Manson at his home in Orange. You're listening to A Country Breakfast. I'm Libby Price. Next, why Australia isn't the food bowl for Asia. Peach growers in some of our most productive farming areas are ripping out trees. They can't sell locally, let alone export, with cheap imports killing their markets.
Hey, Mike and Jesse here from Long Story Short.
This week, we're going back to the time of acne, crushes, of intense friendships that mean everything.
She was my whole world at school, and I was her whole world too, so I don't know what her experience was afterwards, but I really had to find new friends, and that's so hard when you're 14 or 15.
Yes, we're going back to those teenage years.
Stories of falling in and out of love, of addiction and running away. That's this Sunday at 3 on RN.
Whenever the parlous state of much of Australian agriculture is raised as an issue, the defence of an increasing number of people, from the Prime Minister to economists and even this week to Rupert Murdoch, has been, our future lies in becoming the food bowl of Asia. Coming up, you'll hear from University Deans of Agriculture who argue, far from being a food production factory, Australia's falling so far behind in agricultural research, it's just pipe dreaming. First, though, to our very own food bowl. Victoria's Goulburn Valley is in the heart of the Murray-Darling Basin and is one of Australia's most productive and intensively farmed areas. It's home to what was the farmer-owned cooperative Shepherd and Preserving Company, or SPC, which merged with Ardmona and is now owned by Coca-Cola Amatil. So it's big business, and that means no more Mr. Nice Guy. A high Australian dollar has decimated exports for canned fruit, and now growers are being told their crop is worthless. Warwick Long reports.
It is such a waste. Across Victoria's Goulburn Valley, literally thousands of tonnes of fresh fruit is rotting on trees. Without a market, the fruit is worthless, and so the bulldozers and excavators are moving in. Here, an excavator is tearing down trees with 250 tonnes of peaches still hanging at an orchard in northern Victoria.
Yeah, there's definitely a fair bit of heartbreak there. To go through the process of getting your crop to the point where you're about to pick it is a long process, and it's an expensive process, but it's also very rewarding. We love what we grow. It's a great product. So, yeah, to get to this point and go, actually, these peaches aren't going to go anywhere, you know, the way things have worked out, it knocks you around psychologically.
That is Kate Eddy, who grows fruit at Invergordon, north of Shepparton. She's pulling out 2,000 trees and not planning on replanting them. In what should be one of the best fruit growing seasons in living memory, orchardists enjoyed good growing conditions and a bumper crop. But at the same time, fruit canner SPC Ardmona cut the quota for the amount of canning peaches it takes from growers. With no one to buy their fruit, growers across the region have left canning peaches of the highest quality on the tree to rot. And people like Kate Eddy have had to make the heartbreaking decision to call in the heavy machinery to demolish some of their orchard.
This block of Queensland we should be in picking at the moment, but what's happened is we've reached our quota with the cannery and they're not able to move as much fruit as they had. So rather than picking, we'll be getting the excavator in to push them out and leave this ground bare for a little while to try and meet the quotas that are now being placed on our industry.
No one from SPC Ardmona was available for an interview. The company says in a statement that it's hard to see the food go to waste, but it can't be expected to take everything growers produce. That is not good enough for some growers. Further down the road from Invergordon is another town that has generations of fruit growing heritage. I'm now at Cobram on the Victorian New South Wales border. Angelo Diaco blames SPC Ardmona and says they have a responsibility to help growers through hard times.
Oh, we got a good crop out there. We've got 150 ton to go in quota, but we've probably got 250 to 300 ton. So we'll be losing 100 to 150 ton. But we're going to try and market, but I don't think it's going to happen because the prices just aren't there.
So you're going to try and pick it and sell it?
We'll try, but I think you'll be left on the tree somehow.
Is it worth it to grow fruit when you're leaving 100 tonne behind?
No, it's not. It's not worth it.
What's the problem here?
Well, I blame the canneries, the management of the canneries. I've been going in and seeing what's going on. Is just, you know, they're 10 days behind in canning fruit, which is, you know, it's a no-no. The fruit should be in the can within 2-3 days max.
So fruit's literally sitting there for 10 days before
Canned? Oh, yeah, they've got it in cool rooms, but, you know, it's just, it's a canned piece of fruit. They want the fruit ripe. We give it to them ripe. And then they hold it for 10 days because they're running behind and, you know, they just haven't got their act together. It's just not on. And we're suffering. We're the ones that are suffering for it.
What does that do to the product that the cannery's selling if they're leaving it so long?
I probably shouldn't be saying this, Warwick, but, you know, it's not good for our business, but you go and buy a can of SPC product and it's much, mush. It's soft. You know, a piece of fruit's got to be nice and crunchy in a can. It ain't. I went to a chain store the other day. I bought a product from SPC and one from South Africa. The South African one, that was, that's how you put fruit in a can. Or in a plastic container, you know. These guys just aren't doing it here.
So are you worried for the future?
Oh, yeah. I don't think there is a future in canned fruit. The way they're going, there's no future worry. It's not good. You know, a lot of jobs are going to be lost. It's a big, you know, the industry brings in a lot of money for everyone, really. And like we suffer, everyone else is going to suffer.
Back at Kate Eddy's property, the excavator is still hard at work. Basil Madgwick is somewhat of an undertaker for fruit growing. He's been ripping out trees for growers for decades, usually as they prepare to plant the next generation of trees. But now he says he has never been busier, and not many trees are being replaced.
Yeah, it is pretty hard work, yeah, consistent. Tree after tree, nearly makes you cry when you knock them over, exploded with peaches.
Why is it so hard to pull out trees like this mentally?
They'll generally take a few out every year, but now it's just getting worse. They can't get rid of their fruit, and that's it.
And how long have you been doing stuff like this?
About 50-odd years. Back years ago, when took a fair few out, but usually it's just they take out a few acres of the old ones and then put in all new stuff, but now it's got to the stage of taking everything out.
And it must be especially hard to be doing it on a day like today when there's literally tons of, well, hundreds of tons of peaches still on the trees.
Yeah, it is very hard. There's thousands of peaches on it, actually. Yeah, big area.
And how long does it take you to pull out 2,000 peach trees?
You generally do about 100 an hour, roughly, and then you've got to push them up, so that's probably, you know, probably an hour and a half or something, yeah, a bit more, 2 hours, yeah.
No one knows exactly how much fruit is out there. Estimates range between 4 to 10,000 tonnes of peaches have been left behind by growers. As the trees are ripped out, Kate Eddy says growers need help to leave the industry with dignity.
Look, there needs to be a lot of re-evaluation of how much fruit is being grown. There's no doubt about that. You know, we can get angry at, you know, what's being taken, quotas and so on, but that's a reality that we need to address. What needs to happen is people probably need support in doing that. The cost of pushing out trees, of re-evaluating whether your place is going to be an orchard anymore, isn't something that people are in a position to do. And that's probably my concern is that in re-evaluating how much fruit do we grow fruit at all, which I know some orchards will probably be thinking about, it's not an easy industry just to step aside from.
So what do you think the industry needs? Is it government support?
Definitely. Definitely government support. It's not so much about welfare. It's actually about government support to help improve our industry because it does have a future. And if we can improve it, it'll be a good future.
Every one of the dozen fruit growers I've spoken to has mentioned the prospect of a scheme like this. They say if growers were given money to rip out trees, many could leave the industry with dignity, and the future for the remaining orchardists would be secured. However, the calls for the Federal Agriculture Minister to step in have so far gone unanswered. A spokesman for Minister Joe Ludwig's office says a tree pull is not an option.
I am aware of the shortened contracts, and these are commercial matters for the businesses involved. There is little evidence that a tree pull scheme would set the industry on a strong path for the future. The Productivity Commission report into the government drought assistance found that transaction-based subsidies have the potential to interfere with sound business decision-making. This can be the result of businesses making decisions based on an attempt to secure a subsidy, rather than decisions in the interest of their business. Growers can look to alternative markets or products to the cannery and may qualify for grants under Commercialisation Australia should they wish to pursue innovation in their industry.
And with the government not interested in helping, fruit growers are pleading with the community to support them.
Look, I know we have these big pushes for Buy Australian all the time, but it is important that we have a really serious think about supporting our Australian industries. Our community is going to be hit really hard as people downsize, and we want to make sure that everyone needs to be aware of how important our agricultural industry is. And at the moment, I'm not sure we are.
Goulburn Valley orchardist Kate Eddy ending that report from Warwick Long. So now to the future for agriculture. Do we really have the capacity to be more productive and more profitable? The Australian Council of Deans of Agriculture, that's the peak body which represents the heads of the School of Agriculture in Australian universities, says investment in agricultural R&D isn't keeping pace with global population growth. In this election year, they warn Australia risks losing its competitive advantage unless the nation funds a sustainable investment plan in agriculture. Sally Dacus is speaking here with Professor Mark Adams from the University of Sydney and the President of the Council of Deans, Ian Young.
Is Australia a food bowl for Asia? Certainly it's part of the solution. At present, we produce enough food for 60 million people. We're roughly 22 million people here. We're doing a hell of a job already, and we need to do a far better job. And that's where the government has to invest into research, into agriculture. That is a key. If they want us to produce the food for the future, they need to give us the tools to do that. And part of the tools is a sustainable investment plan for agriculture.
And are they doing that? How's it tracking?
Well, I think we are doing quite well in some instances and quite bad in other instances. We're looking to the future here, not what's happening now, and we certainly need a far greater investment into agriculture. Across the board, the Deans were busy yesterday looking at where the gaps are, and we believe the gaps are in the strategic basic side, the fundamental side, the questions, the really hard questions of how to increase efficiency using the high-level science. And also the adoption side, how once we come up with the solutions, can we get the farmers and the industry, because it's not just the farmers, it's the whole value chain that we need to look at. How do we get those industries and those markets to become aware of the innovations that are going on in the laboratory, that go out into the field, and then go out into the mass market?
Mark Adams, what's industry telling you about what they want in their graduates and to harness and capture this potential?
Industry's pretty dry-eyed. I think every farmer would tell you that they make business decisions every day of the week. And so I think collectively that's what they want. They want to see decisions made. They want to see clear decisions made about investment in R&D. And then they want to see that followed through all the way to when we can adopt the new practices that we've developed. Just one statistic that I think is quite chilling. The rate of growth in the world's population, which everybody hears about all the time, is now not matched by the rate of growth in investment in R&D to feed the population. Now, this has been going on for over a decade, that we have flatlined our R&D investment in food production across the world, and the developed countries are particularly culpable because we've had the money to do it, but we haven't put that money there. So I think everybody can understand that if the rate of growth in your population is X, surely the rate of growth in your investment to feed those people is also going to have to be X, and we haven't. And so industry is aware of this. If you talk to the world's leading agricultural economists, people like Phil Pardee at Minnesota, he will give you chapter and verse the investment that's been made in recent times and what the return on the investment, which is fantastic, but it's not matching population growth.
But is it a chicken and egg situation until you get the profitability coming out of the industry to reinvest in future R&D? It's hard to do that.
It is. It's hard to balance it across all of the different agricultural sectors. That's the hardest part. So you can have a bumper wheat crop in Western Australia, a dud in the east. You can have great dairy production in Tasmania, but, you know, production might be collapsing in northern New South Wales. That's the hard part. It's very hard to match R&D investment with income. But this is a case of market failure. At the very time when if your production is falling, you need to be investing in R&D. Now, the Deans of Ag are acutely aware that this has happened in Australia through the drought, that one of the reasons why we've got the problem is that the wheat crop was not good, there wasn't the money coming through, and so the investment in R&D fell away. Wrong. That's when you need to be investing, and that's where governments need to step in and be the leaven, the ups and downs in agricultural production, because our R&D is funded from a levy, mostly, on production. And so if production goes down, the levy goes down. Classic market failure.
Well, let's put it in the political climate of a federal election later this year. Good, bad, otherwise, what do you think might the outcome be either way?
And this is us. This is the Deans of Agriculture. We have to be prepared for the outcome, whatever it is. And so we are committed to making both sides of politics fully aware of, firstly, our competitive advantage in Australia, which has rested very much with our willingness to be science leaders in agriculture. And secondly, if you want a strong and prosperous Australian economy in the future, you better rethink some of the investments in R&D that have been happening in the last decade, because they just haven't been keeping pace with where they should be.
And a final word from you, Ian Young, from the University of New England.
I believe we're at a tipping point for agriculture in Australia. The opportunities are huge, but what the government doesn't want to do, no matter the colour of the political party, is to be seen to be failing to take this opportunity for investment. Invest now, and we become the best in the world. Lack of investment, as Mark says, means we slip back, and our efficiencies that have been hard won and hard fought for will not be realised for the future generation. And I would caution anyone listening to this who has the power to invest in agriculture, is now is the time to secure agriculture and food production for the future generation in Australia.
Ian Young from the University of New England in New South Wales. He's president of the Australian Council of Deans of Agriculture. We also heard from Professor Mark Adams from the University of Sydney. And that's a Country Breakfast for this week. Details of all our stories, rural news, photos, and how to get a podcast of the program are on our website, abc.net.au/rural. Thanks for joining the Rural Team this morning, and thanks to our technical producer, Kerry Dell. On RN, I'm Libby Price. Talk to you soon.